Thanks for joining us today as our monthly visit with psychiatrist Mark Whaley and psychologist Michael Abruzzese. And they join me in our Woods Hole studio. Hello, doctors.
Good morning.
Hi, Sean.
Our discussion today is about diagnosis, and we invite you to call with your questions. Maybe you want to know where to go for a diagnosis, or perhaps you want to know the value of having a diagnosis. The doctors can answer those questions and more. Give us a call, 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626. Or you can email your question if you're a little shy. That's thepoint@wgbh.org. Let's start with how mental health professionals go about making a diagnosis. I mean, I know if the body is sick in some way, my primary care doctor might give me a blood test or do a physical examination of some type. How does it work with mental health issues?
Well, I can point out that mental health issues are different than going to your primary care doctor, getting a blood test, and therefore, if your blood count is low, you got anemia, and that's the fact. With mental health, it's different. Let me put it in historical context. Modern psychiatry really kind of dates back to the mid-1800s or so and has developed since then after, you know, obviously the Middle Ages when whatever was psychiatry or psychology was quite different. But modern, it goes back to the mid-1800s. And really it started with what would be called the descriptive school of psychiatry, mainly with people like M.L. Kraepelin, who used to write very flowery descriptions of mental disorders, schizophrenia and bipolar disorder, that even if you read those now, they apply. So I suppose you could say it's comforting to know that mental illnesses haven't changed in 150 years as perhaps what was being seen then. After that got going, the psychoanalytic school came in, and we all know about Freud and how he emphasized, instead of what was observable in terms of descriptive signs, he emphasized the inner workings of the mind and the forces in the mind. And when there's conflict, that's when you get mental illness and disorder. And he based his diagnoses on that conception. In England, there was another school that developed in the 30s, 40s, 50s, the existential school. And then the big dominant school now is the biological one. And that started with the 50s and 60s. Now, you'd think that with biology, we would have a blood test for it, just like you do for the anemia or something that you go see your doctor for. But in all these years, we have not developed any reliable what's called a biological marker for any psychiatric disorder. So we can't get an X-ray, we can't do a blood test and say that this person has schizophrenia based on that result versus this person does not, or this person has major depression versus this person does not. We've not developed that. And the reason we wanted to have this show today to talk about this topic is that psychiatry is about to produce a new diagnostic manual that has really, this has really dominated the field since the 80s. And it has really gone back to descriptive psychiatry, where modern psychiatry started. That's what we're at now. We're back at describing symptoms. The difference now is that the manual that comes out and has come out, the third version came out in 1980, all lists specific criteria for each disorder. And I think there's about 1,500 or so disorders. Or no, there's a number of them. That's the wrong number. But at any rate, each of them has specific criteria. If you it's like a Chinese food menu. If you have A, B, and C, then you got it. If you have A and C, you don't have it. You need B. And there's trade-offs, et cetera. So it sort of makes for a system that seems real, just like the anemia diagnosis is in medicine, but it's still different because it's based on what's observable that you see and not reliably measured. And each observer can see something different in it. You have to take all psychiatric diagnoses, I think, with a grain of salt. They're very useful to have. We need to have standardization, and that's what the DSM, which is called the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, is. That's what it represents. But you have to take it with a grain of salt. We can talk about how it's developed, but it's not the Bible that people make it out to be.
What role do – go ahead.
Well, I would have to disagree with a couple of, I think, what I would call conclusions that Mark has mentioned. Certainly his history is accurate, and I think I would probably have to say in terms of diagnostic workups, one of the major flaws, one of the major drawbacks, one of the major tragedies, I guess, is when Freud decided to come up with diagnostic classifications when he tried to do something he thought was good and codify things. Biographers have told us that Freud was trying to make a position for himself in schools, and he was a neurologist, and because he was Jewish, he couldn't get a position. And so he fell in love with something that he called psychology. And as he was coming up with all these conditions that he was noticing, he determined that there was something different. He said the mental situation is different from the physical system. And he was the very first person who either demarcated or created so-called mental illness or mental health versus physical health. And I think we know now, after all these years, you really can't separate the two.
Right.
And certainly you and Mark both talked about mental health and mental illness, mental wellness, and there's really no difference. I mean, I think that's just leftover from the legacy that Freud perpetrated to draw attention to these important facts. And we really now call it behavioral health because we're describing behavior, and we're imputing the fact that there's a sort of mentality about that, a mentation about it. And certainly our brain is involved because our brain is involved in everything, but calling it mental health perpetuates stigma and also recreates the diagnostic schism that Freud, innocently enough, came up with a diagnostic category. So we're talking about diagnoses now based on as Mark said, a belief about 150 years ago. There's a big difference. And we know now that physical health is very strongly linked to behavioral health, and some of our best treatments for behavioral health involves physical behavior, like walking and exercise.
Absolutely.
And yoga, stuff like
yeah.
that.
Yeah.
And the problem with diagnostic categories now, and we hit upon this the last month when we talked about antidepressant medication, is inter-rater reliability of rating scales. So the DSM is really a giant rating scale and could be vastly improved if it was written and designed in a basic, fundamentally different way that trained people on how to use it. And people aren't trained to use the DSM, which is why you have widely varying ideas. Oh, this person must be bipolar. No, this other kind of person fits that category too. There's no unanimity because of the lack of inter-rater reliability. You've got a number of categories, and God bless them, they tried the best they could to come up with the A, B, and C category, but people still find a way to misuse that and misunderstand
it. Yeah.
What about the insurance companies? Do they want this DSM, this manual? Is that something that you have to have a diagnosis based on this DSM in order to get coverage?
That's right.
Really? Okay.
This DSM really kind of drives insurance companies' decisions. It also drives research. There's a lot at stake in terms of whether somebody has a diagnosis or not. For instance, one of the purported reasons for the increased supposed incidence of autism now is that parents report signs that might be relatively minor, but what it results in is state-funded educational help. So it's in their interest to get their kid extra help if they have some signs that seem to fit autism. So now we have a diagnostic manual. Actually, this is one of the controversies of this new one that's coming out about what's the definition of autism, and there's going to be some changes in that definition in this new manual.
Right, that's really true. And years ago when Asperger's, a definition of a subtype of autism came out, there's no Asperger's in the DSM.
Right.
You can't diagnose someone with Asperger's and expect to have the insurance company pay for it. It's not a recognized diagnosis.
Exactly.
But clearly there was a lot of money put into different state agencies in different states and from the federal government to provide for people who had, I think, what is more properly now called the autistic spectrum disorders.
That's what they're calling it.
And
yeah.
They had a lot of money for that. You know,
right.
So people naturally went in to seek that kind of diagnosis. And I think it's important to mention that just as it is that psychiatric medication is vastly more prescribed by physicians than a non-psychiatrist,
right.
Psychological diagnoses are vastly more given by physicians who are not psychologists. You go to your general general practitioner. You go to your pediatrician. General practitioner listens to you for a few minutes, may diagnose you as depressed or anxious. Very rare that they will send someone to a psychologist to get a diagnostic workup to see if they are or not. Same thing. Someone comes in, they say you have ADHD, they have autism, something like that. Those diagnoses by far come from the medical establishment, you know, general practitioners and pediatricians and internists, stuff like that, more than mental health, behavioral health practitioners.
So, yeah, that was my next question. Excuse me. How about dealing with children? You know, ADD, ADHD, autism. Mm-hmm. Is that something that you should go first to your pediatrician to diagnose, or should you go elsewhere?
What's
the process?
The short answer is probably you don't get the best service from your pediatrician, and I'm speaking across the country, not just the pediatricians that we have locally. I think a lot of the pediatricians we have locally are very much tuned into these psychological diagnoses now, and they have referrals, contacts that they can send out for confirmation. But I can't say that's true across the country. But having said that, it's really a great idea to go somewhere. So I don't want to stop people from going anywhere. So if you're going to start with your pediatrician or the next door neighbor who's a nurse, I want you to do that. I want you to go see your pediatrician, your general practitioner, at least start someplace. And if things aren't getting much better, then you might want to get a second opinion. But it's really driven, I think, Mark, in your field too, driven by the insurance company. If you don't have the right insurance,
yeah, that's a factor.
You can't get, you're going to take what you can get.
You're
not going to pay for you to go anywhere.
Exactly.
So how about a situation where you have a child and you think that child is just being a kid, you're watching their behavior, these are typical behaviors for children that you think, but someone else points something out, a school counselor or a teacher or a family member, what should a parent do?
I think first is listen and not block it out, take it as this other person has an agenda, and indeed they may. But the first thing is to listen to the message. There might be something in it. Don't just attack the messenger. And then you, as a parent, like anything else, you have to make a judgment. You want to look for some of the things maybe that they're pointing out and see if there's another perspective that they're seeing that you're not reacting to, because if you really want to raise your child the best way you can, you want to use all information that you can gather. So the first step is just to listen non-judgmentally. And if you start feeling yourself rejecting it, then you got to look at yourself a little bit more deeply.
First step. It's really true. It's also true to understand that schools cannot make any diagnosis. So the schools can't make any diagnosis. So if they say, gee, we think maybe you might want to bring your child to a pediatrician for such and such condition, that's the best they could do. They can't say, I think your kid has ADD. You got to go. They can't tell you that because by law they're prohibited from making any kind of diagnosis. They can certainly diagnose a learning disability because that's primarily their job. But if they're coming to you and they're speaking to you in kind of, it may seem like very subtle kinds of ways, or they're not very explicit about what they're saying, they really are prohibited from doing that by law. So they can't come out any more firmly than they are. And if they're recommending you should maybe think about possibly kind of seeing someone, that's about the best they can do. So don't just dismiss that. As Mark is saying, you should really listen to what they're saying.
Right. And the other point I think that is valid here is that these disorders, a lot of them are inherited. So you might see something in your kid that you don't want to, that you know is you, but you might not want to acknowledge it. That's a resistance. It's very interesting. In my practice, I see the child being diagnosed, say, with ADD, ADHD, and then a few months later, the husband's in he sees, he's got the same thing, and he's been struggling with it.
Or else it's the wife that says, he's just like my husband. I hear more than that than the husband said.
Yeah. We're speaking with psychiatrist Mark Whaley and psychologist Michael Abruzzese about diagnosing behavioral health problems, and we invite you to give us a call, 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626. Or you can email thepoint@wgbh.org. What's the value of having a diagnosis? What do you do with that?
Well, originally diagnoses were invented as a kind of a shorthand so physicians could speak to each other. So if someone had influenza, next doctor who sees them, you have influenza, they sort of get what that means. But I got to be honest, when people come into my office and say, I've been diagnosed with such and such condition, I do my own diagnostic workup because I just can't trust the fact that whoever they came from, you know, did the quality kind of diagnostic workup that I have. So it originally started out very well-meaning to be a shorthand for physicians. It was never meant for people to know their own diagnoses for any particular reason. That doesn't help them at all. It just communicates. If you're in a hospital, you want to communicate to other people and the personnel of the hospital as quickly as you can what they're dealing with when someone's in the emergency room, or what they're dealing with when someone goes from one doctor's office to another doctor's office in a different town. But it's taken on a whole life of itself. You know, Mark, I think, has mentioned that people went out and bought the DSM-IV off the bookshelves, and you can buy it at Barnes & Noble. It's coming out in May. You can buy it. And people go through it, and they try and diagnose themselves or diagnose someplace else. And again, that's the inter-rater reliability. You can have a number of symptoms based on a condition that's listed in the DSM-IV or the ICD-9 or 10, but that doesn't mean that you have it. Mm-hmm. That doesn't mean a lot of variables have to be taken into consideration.
Well, there's one other value to having a diagnosis that I found is it makes once with the patient themselves, once they are labeled and if they kind of agree and see what the various features are, that helps them. It decreases some of their stigma. They don't feel that they're crazy or they're the only one. But they can see that they fit into a pattern that other people do and other people have coped with and have done something about.
Right. In that respect, there are some people who really want to know. They want to get some closure. They say, I know I have something. What is it that I have? And they need that. That's part of the helpful healing process. So those folks, certainly diagnosis is
right.
helpful.
Right.
But there are other folks who find it unhelpful whatsoever because as soon as they get a diagnosis, they don't think of it as a diagnostic category. They think of it as a label, and they adopt a persona of someone who has that label.
That
so they act like someone who is a such and such condition. And we don't want people to do that.
Right. Right.
Well, we hear a lot about misdiagnosis, particularly when dealing with injuries or diseases such as cancer, something like that. But what about misdiagnosis in the behavioral health field? Should people always be seeking a second opinion?
Well, you could seek a second opinion or third opinion, but I think, as Mark mentioned earlier, the descriptive aspect is much more important. It doesn't matter if someone has a label of this, that, or the other. The question is, okay, if you have these behaviors and they're interfering with your life, what are you going to do about it? The only reason in that those diagnostic categories are helpful is if it's going to lead to any kind of helpful treatment. But once a diagnosis is put in to the medical system, it never leaves you. It never leaves. If you were diagnosed 30 years ago with schizophrenia and now you have no signs or symptoms of schizophrenia, then you're diagnosed with schizophrenia in remission. It doesn't mean that you don't have it. And that thing follows you everywhere. And now with the data crunching and the data mining that's going on, psychological diagnosis, physical diagnosis, you know, they're talking about mapping your genes, the propensity for a potential diagnosis in the future, all influences your ability to get any kind of insurance and can boost your rate in getting auto insurance, getting house insurance, getting any life insurance, and you will never know why.
Wow.
You will never know why.
Don is calling from Falmouth. Hello, Donna.
Hello.
What's your question today?
I have a question.
Yes.
Once a diagnosis is made of depression, how do you go about finding a psychiatrist to treat you?
Okay.
Well, I assume you're calling from the Cape, and it's a difficult task. It's not easy. There is a shortage. Psychiatrists are helped out or are extended more or less by psychiatric nurse practitioners, and they really are. Many of them are very competent and can do much the same thing that a psychiatrist can do. You have to search. Ask your internist. Ask your friends. And then make some calls. And if they don't have time or take your insurance, ask for referrals because they'll be in a little bit more a better position to know who's available and who's around in the area. There are clinics. There are several of them. Cape Cod Hospital runs one. There's a couple of other out of Hyannis. Then there's some private practitioners scattered and few, but they are there. You just have to search.
I think probably a good place to also start is with your insurance company. Go on their website.
Yeah.
They will have usually a listing of people who are on their panel, psychiatrists, internists, psychologists, social workers, and that's also a good place to start. It may be necessary for you to go outside of the area to get an initial workup. And typically, once you get a very good workup, for psychiatric medication, most likely a lot of internists, your GP is in the Cape, will be happy to refill the prescription since the workup was done by someone maybe at Bradley Hospital or someone in Boston or something like that. So don't try and limit yourself geographically. We do have the community mental health centers that Mark talked about, and not just on the Cape, but also you can go to Plymouth, you can go to Wareham. There are others in other high population centers that have psychiatrists on staff.
Thank you, Donna. So we hear sometimes about people who are hesitant to go to a behavioral health professional or send their children to a professional because they think the only answer is medication or drugs. So what's your response to that? Is that true?
No, that's
patently false. That's not the only answer. And if that's keeping somebody away, then they're misinformed. They're resisting for other reasons, really.
It's important to understand that even if someone does make a recommendation, if I recommend someone to a psychiatrist, a clinical social worker, or a nurse, and Mark even recommends medication, it's up to the patient. They can always say, no, I don't want to do that.
Absolutely.
We can't force anyone to take medication.
No. Ideally, we're educators and offer options, and it's the people, the person who gets the choice, who has the choice, they own it.
What type of fees can someone expect when seeking a diagnosis? Is it similar to an hourly rate that someone might pay for treatment or counseling?
Well, the way you phrase the question to a psychologist means, are you asking about a psychological assessment, like a psychological testing, neuropsychological testing, which usually does involve a separate fees, as opposed to a clinical diagnosis or clinical treatment? I don't think the field is quite the same for psychiatrists. Do the work all the same?
Right.
But in any case, insurance company pays for it.
Yeah.
I mean, it's pretty much driven by the insurance company. Yeah. Sometimes you may not be able to find someone who will do a psychological testing or neuropsychological testing because the insurance company does not pay enough to cover the cost. Those are usually quite expensive. And you may have to go someplace either out of plan or to pay that out of your pocket. But again, you have so many private practitioners and people who work in clinics that if they have a private practice on the side, it's a market out there. You can find someone who can work out a payment plan. There's no set fee. It's different from person to person, agency to agency. And you'd be able to get either a payment plan if you need a neuropsychological assessment that is not covered by insurance. But that is not a typical case. Most folks don't need a neuropsych assessment or a psych testing. And I just meant the psych testing. Most initial psychological testing done for children is done by the school, and that is free. You have to request it as part of your Chapter 766 individual education plan workup, and schools typically give very common psychological tests given by a school psychologist, which can be the first step and may be the only psychological testing that you need. But if it is not, you can simply bring those results to a child psychologist in private practice and get that person's opinion if they think any supplementary test might be needed, and they can provide the supplementary test.
Are you saying that you have to have an IEP or one being drafted in order to get that testing, or you can get the testing before an IEP is even brought
up? You get that tested before an IEP. Under Massachusetts law, if you believe your child has special needs, you can go to the school. You say, I think my child needs some help.
Right.
And I mean no disrespect to the school systems when I say this, but my experience is that some school systems or teachers will try and talk you out of it. You simply have to be firm and say, listen, this is my right under law. I believe my child has got some special needs. We have to take this to the next step. And that as soon as that letter is sent in to the Director of Special Services or Pupil Services or Special Education in the town, that starts the clock ticking on the legal requirement as part of the adjudication process as to whether or not a child has any special needs. Some testing has to be given, have to give academic testing, and in the majority of cases that I'm aware of, psychological testing, limited psychological testing. And that from that testing, then you have a team meeting to determine whether an IEP is needed or not. So you're quite right in phrasing your question. The testing is done before the IEP can be determined because the testing provides information to help them determine whether an IEP is needed.
Yeah, I don't have anything to add to that. In terms of an adult, getting a diagnosis, getting an evaluation is the same as going to your primary care doctor. You pay for the office visit.
Yeah.
Let's see. Let's go back to something you mentioned earlier, Dr. Abruzzese. You were talking about someone, if they had a diagnosis 30 years ago, that diagnosis stays with them. Is there value in going just on your own to get that diagnosis confirmed? Is there an imperative to go and you know, confirm that years later because maybe things have progressed or maybe you have misdiagnosed that subject?
Well, let's talk about the example I gave, schizophrenia in remission. If you have schizophrenic symptoms, you don't need anyone to tell you. You pretty much know it, and you don't really have to go anywhere. I have had patients come to me and say, I think I'm such and such. You know, can you confirm this? And sometimes they're accurate and sometimes they're not accurate. You know, and both times when I either confirm or disconfirm, people have gotten angry with me because they're so committed to that diagnosis, whatever it is, they don't want to hear anything else. Other times people don't think they have something when they do. They have a copycat condition. A lot of people come in thinking they have ADHD when in fact they don't. They're misdiagnosed. ADHD has symptomatology that is common to a variety of psychological conditions and behavioral disorders. And sometimes people are very surprised to find that they either do not have ADHD, they thought they did, or they have ADHD and they thought they had depression or anxiety. So it works both ways.
Yeah, I would agree. The only value is of confirming, disconfirming, whatever, is how much the, quote, symptoms, whatever they might be, interfere with your life. If they're not interfering, go about your life. You live it.
Right.
Don't bother with this.
Right. I mean, I think, Mark, in your case, you have patients who have some kind of medical condition, you know, and it's under control, and they don't see their doctor very frequently because everything is copacetic, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, so it's same thing.
Yeah, same thing. Yeah.
We've only got a couple minutes left. You both were the ones who decided helped decide on the topic today. Were there other issues that you wanted to bring up or thought we should discuss for the benefit of the audience?
Just to mention, there is a big controversy about bipolar disorder in children, and that's going to be a part of this new diagnostic manual that's coming out. In the 90s and the 2000s, there was a lot of kids diagnosed as bipolar, which is a condition that you generally have for life. And these kids just don't have that. But they were diagnosed that way because they were mood irritable or temper tantrum kind of kids ages where they shouldn't be throwing them. At any rate, they were then given major antipsychotic drugs, which have bad side effects, all of which has led to this, in this new diagnostic manual, a narrowing of that definition and a reworking of it. And I think the bottom line is just that a diagnosis is a hypothesis. It's a place to start, and then you go from there.
It's okay. Really important to understand that. Anytime someone gets a diagnosis in behavioral health, it's advisory, and it's not written in stone. It
right.
Isn't.
Okay. On that point, I want to thank my guests, psychologist Michael Abruzzese and psychiatrist Mark Whaley. Thank you both.
Thank you.
And I'd like to thank Mindy Todd for asking me to fill in for her today. I'm Sean Corcoran. Thanks for listening.
The Point airs weekdays at 9:30 a.m. and 7:30 p.m. We're also on Facebook at The Point, WCAI. Amy Vince produces The Point. Mindy Todd is executive producer. Production assistance from Jenny Junker. Music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter. The Point is a production of the Cape and Islands NPR stations, a service of WGBH.